thanks for inviting me to give this talk. I wanted to give a talk on the four Bodhisattva vows because it's they have a lot of meaning to me, and more so over the last few years. And it's interesting to me to see the slight variations between these two forms, and I'm guessing in other sanghas there's other forms. And however you say them, they're actually impossible. So I was thinking that I wanted to start this talk by talking about what is a bodhisattva? What are we talking about here? So I found some definitions. So Wikipedia, where I always go first, says, in Buddhism, bodhisattva is the Sanskrit term for anyone who, motivated by great compassion, has generated bodhicitta, which they say is a spontaneous wish and a compassionate mind to attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. So that's how they define bodhisattva. The more traditional way, which I found in another website, is bodhisattva is a person who is able to reach nirvana, but delays doing so out of compassion in order to save suffering beings. So that's how I was brought up in Zen, to think of a bodhisattva, somebody who kind of delays their own saving to help other beings. And another definition I found is, it was quite a literal translation, a person whose essence is perfect knowledge. So that comes from bodhi, which means perfect knowledge, and sattva, which means being or essence. And bodhi, the root of that is the same root as Buddha, which is awakened. So a being whose essence is perfect knowledge. And then I found this tricycle article that talked about, there's a whole article about bodhisattvas, and what they say is, you could define a bodhisattva as one who acts as a true adult. Ordinary people live thinking only about their personal narrow circumstances connected with their desires. In contrast to that of bodhisattva, though undeniably still an ordinary human being, like everyone else, lives by vow. And their vow is a specific motivation of their life to serve others. So I was thinking how to make this simpler, to think about these vows together. And I was thinking a really nice definition of that unconsciously I always thought of a bodhisattva as a mensch, which is Yiddish for a good person. So if you think of a bodhisattva as someone who does good, or at least intends to do good, and the direction for how to do that good are in these vows, which again are ridiculously impossible. And I remember as a young Zen student really taking them seriously and thinking, I used it always as a gauge for how I wasn't there yet. And my current teacher, Melissa Blacker, gave a talk once that really healed that to some extent in me. She talked about the impossibility of these vows, and if you read them, it's just, it's not even hard to see how incredibly impossible they all are. I mean, beings are numberless, and I vowed to free them. I mean, that's ridiculous. And she talked about seeing these vows as more like arrows shooting in the right direction. She said, you may never hit the bullseye, but at least you know you're shooting in the right direction. And her talk helped me understand that instead of using these vows as, in some ways, a violence toward myself, it's a whip, to always judge myself, it's not enough. I could see them more as a compass to set myself straight. You know, and when I'm confused or when I'm not sure the right thing to do, I do go back and look at these, and they do guide me. It's It's very helpful. And I also heard another talk about these vows that really has influenced me in a major way, and I actually recalled this talk. Somehow it came up to consciousness, and I heard the talk maybe. Actually, I know exactly when I heard it, because my daughter, who's now 34, was a year old, and there was a women's Buddhist conference, the first one on the East Coast, and I really wanted to go, and it seemed impossible. I was working, I had this little baby, how could I go to a Buddhist conference? And I figured it's for and by women, so I called them, and they, in fact, supported me in coming, and they found some child care for me. I couldn't go to all the talks, but I did get to go to several, and the most important one was this one that Jan Chosen Bays, who's now a Zen teacher in Portland, Oregon, a really wonderful teacher. If you ever get your hands on anything that she's written, she's just wonderful. So she started this talk by standing in front of this crowd of women. It was like totally overbooked, this conference. People were so hungry for it. And she said, I feel a little funny giving a talk because I'm not used to talking in front of so many people, and I just flew here from the West Coast and my hair is funny. She actually said that. She said, I'm having a bad hair day, how can I give a talk? And her hair was funny. It was very, it was lopsided kind of. And you know, I immediately fell in love with this woman. And I was really ready to hear whatever she had to say, because my teachers had always been these Zen guys, you know, most of them were Asian, you know, and Korean or Japanese, and some of whom didn't even speak English. I was so hungry for the practice, but it was not easy. And here was this woman who not only spoke English and was kind of near my age, but also had bad hair. So I was so grateful. So this talk that she gave on the four bodhisattva vows, she talked about, like me, what my experience was, that she was an incredible perfectionist, and she drove herself crazy with these vows. And what she finally decided to do was that when she says them the right way, and then she turns them around. So I'll give you an example of that. So when you say, sentient beings are not for this, I vow to free them, you also say, I am freed by all sentient beings. I'll say it again. So, sentient beings are numberless. I vow to free them. I am freed by all sentient beings. And I've sat with this method. I do this pretty much daily, actually, because it really, really helps me. And that's why I wanted to share this with you. That if I think of myself as this separate being who's going to run around and save all beings, which as a codependent I do all the time, you know, I'm a certified codependent. And what I have found over the years is that's not particularly helpful to anybody, including myself. And this turning it around, I am saved by all beings, is equally true, more true. That when I say it that way, I am no longer a separate being trying to help everybody else. And, you know, there's all these beings that I don't even know about. How can I even help them? I mean, I try to help everybody in my life to, again, you know, as a codependent, to a fault. But then there's all these beings I don't know about. But if I turn it around and say, I am saved by all beings, then we become one being. Makes sense. Is that too esoteric? Is that too out there? That, and it's very practical for me, actually. I mean, I know that if I'm walking down the street, maybe I'm having a bad hair day or something, and if a stranger smiles at me, it turns stuff around. Or, you know, the other day I was in Publix, and this funny thing happened. I don't even know how to describe it, but there was this. It was like right before dinner, and this woman was with her Lucky was about 4 years old, and the kid was tired and probably hungry, and he was having a tantrum. He wanted this bag of whatever it was, some kind of chocolate candy. And the way she dealt with this child somehow kicked me back several decades to reflect on a situation with one of my kids, and I am saved by all beings. This woman in Publix kind of gave me a great parenting lesson. The whole thing lasted around 40 seconds, you know? And this is how life is, you know? Life comes to us in unexpected ways, and we have to bow to it all the time. Actually, I was thinking of giving this talk, I was thinking about the dog downstairs to me, Charlie, who I adore, and we actually adore each other. It never fails that when Charlie kisses me or rubs against my leg, he lets me know he loves me, you know, and this is another being who affects me all the time. And or if I'm riding my bike someplace and all of a sudden there's a heron, you know, this happened to me yesterday. It's like you can't help but say we are so blessed by all beings. So the next line, and I'm going to try and say both of them, just, they're not that different, but just, it helps to say both of them. So, delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to transform them. And the way I'm used to saying it is, delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Not so different, but just a little different. But when you turn it around and you say, not only do I vow to end or transform all delusions, but I am actually transformed by my delusions, right? And I actually like the balance way. I am ended by my delusions. Any sense, any attachment I have to some sense of self, some self-image I have, is blasted away on an ongoing basis. My delusions, I'm ended by. I have some thought about myself or a thought about someone else that's actually a deluded thought. The universe would hit me on the side of the head and say, look at what you did, or look at what you said, or look at the belief you held. And, you know, instead of going around again as a separate being, trying to stamp out all my delusions, which are really inexhaustible. I can trust that if I'm really screwed up, I will get the message. I will be ended. I will be transformed by my delusions. Does that make sense? How am I doing? So practice paths are boundless. I vow to study them, which is somewhat different, but in essence the same, but somewhat different from Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. So I like to think of myself as somebody who can go anywhere, or I'll take up a challenge, whatever it is. And that's a self-image. I have another delusion I carry. But in fact, there's places I don't want to go. I mean, literally, neighborhoods I don't want to walk into, emotional places. I don't want to go. We've been reading this book for our Zen book club, Tara Brach's Radical Acceptance. And I've been having that book on my end table next to my bed for like maybe 5 years or more. And I think I really didn't want to read that book, and I didn't know why. And now reading it, I know why I didn't want to read it. It's intense. She brought me to places that I did not. And I think somehow I would have conveniently put the book down if I weren't reading it with a group of people. I think I would have gotten buried under other books. And I'm so glad I read it. And I made myself to read the exercises. She invites you to look at your grief and your longing and your anger in ways that I wasn't really interested in doing. And there's, you know, there are internal Dharma gates that I don't want to enter, and internal and external places I really don't want to go, consciously or unconsciously. And again, the universe provides us with the education we need. And these Dharma gates will be presented to us, and probably the ones we're most resistant to are the ones that will be most strongly presented, and we will go through those gates either gracefully or kicking and screaming, but we will be brought through those gates. And that's certainly been my experience. So again, Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them, and I am entered by boundless Dharma gates. Practice paths are boundless. I vow to study them, and I am studied by boundless practice paths, even the ones I'm not really interested in. So the last vow of the enlightened way is incomparable. I vow to embody it. Now the Buddha way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. So right there, you know, there's any perfectionist nightmare. You know, you say something is impossible, and then you say, and I'm going to do it. And I think when I was a younger Zen student, first of all, I really didn't know what that way was. I mean, if somebody asked me to define it, I probably couldn't, but I had, you know, images of probably some white guy or some Asian guy up in a mountain somewhere with a beard, which I wasn't clearly. Or I had images, you know, always I'm selfish, always giving, never bothered by the crazy thoughts. Because if I were the Buddha way, would be really peaceful in there. So here I was vowing to attain this thing. By definition, is that possible? So turning it around, saying the Buddha way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it, and I am embodied by the Buddha way. Really is a far more compassionate and maybe more authentically Buddhist in a way. I mean, in fact, the Buddha himself said, we are all already Buddha. We are all already Buddha, which when we are used to self-judgment and using the whip on ourselves and always thinking we can do better, we don't usually pay attention to that line the Buddha said. But in fact, we are already Buddha. We, in all our imperfections, we are already Buddha. We already embody the Buddha way. I want to say that again because it's so hard to hear that. Each of us in our imperfections embody the Buddha way perfectly. And when we can allow this for ourselves, we can really have the compassion to say this about ourselves, then our hearts open, and we can actually even say that about our spouse, for instance, or Mr. Trump, for instance. Other beings also are Buddha, perfectly, even in our imperfection. So, thank you. I can't remember what happened. We sit quietly for a little bit.
We can open it up to questions or comments, and then we have this tradition where if someone wants to speak, they bow, and then you acknowledge with a bow.
Actually, before you mentioned Mesh, word came out. Mesh. So, as you were listening, and I really enjoyed what you were saying, the whole source of course. But I wonder if we can twist it around and start with all our imperfections, and we could begin with our perfection, and we start with our perfection, and then we go awry with all our delusions. Mm. But basically, what we're going through, the path is trying to get back to our perfection.
Mm-hmm.
So, as you were talking, I was thinking, maybe that's where we can begin. I can begin from there.
So is that helpful to you? To do it like that? Yeah. I mean, I think people have been grappling with this for thousands of years, you know, original sin and the Garden of Eden. You know, human beings have been talking about this forever and ever. And I think we each have to find our own path. You know, so when I offered these vows and turning them around, it's just one skillful means, you know, and another might be to really honor our perfections and look at what happens. Does that make sense?
Yeah. The other part that I always grapple with, because coming from a, psychological and professional background, you know, the word delusion has all sorts of meaning, and I'm always and I haven't really figured it out where delusion from my psychological background, you know, which delusion is always referred to is in terms of mental illness, neurosis, etc. And so you think that this is what Buddha is talking about, or is he talking about delusion on a different level? I'll throw that out to you.
All I can tell you is my thinking, my own personal thinking about that. But I think that in the realm of Buddhist practice, we deal with the range. I mean, obviously, we have to recognize that there are psychological delusions. There are people who really are in trouble. But in Buddhist practice, there's a whole spectrum of delusion that we talk about, including the very basic one that most human beings on this planet suffer with, is that we're a separate self.
Okay.
You know, and that's a delusion that gets all of us in trouble all the time. You know, and I don't think that's in the, whatever that...
DSM.
Yeah. I don't think they have that in there.
Multiple personality.
All right. Yeah, but, you know, having one personality, you know, in Buddhism is like...
It's hard enough.
It's hard enough. Yeah. Well, thank you.
I just want to say thank you. I feel like it's one heart speaking directly to 10 hearts, and I was like on the verge of tears the whole time. Just thank you for this. And the only thing that I really feel can kind of boil this all down for me is making the shift from thinking that it's me working on my practice. Okay, here I go. Here's my koan, and let me crack it. Let me work on it. Versus the practice working on me, which is an entirely different approach. It's an allowing for the, I don't have to figure it out. It figures me out.
It does.
It feels better that way.
And it does, right?
Yeah.
And it
does. Mm-hmm.
Time, right? So we have time for another question.
Just a comment from what Lori just said. You know, doing it, flipping it around, is doing it in a relaxed, heart-centered way. The other way is very, it can be, it doesn't have to be, but I'm just having this experience in this moment that from what you said. It's really working. It's hard. It makes it work. It makes it hard, as opposed to allowing and coming from inside the heart, as opposed to inside the head. That's just my experience right now.
Yeah,
and appreciating that, looking at it that way. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeannie. So.
This is clapping.
Thursday is Thanksgiving, so no sitting Thursday evening will be closed just for that day, but I'll be in town, so we will be meeting next Sunday. So if you're around, please come sit with us next Sunday. I think we'll have a smaller group, but we'll be here. And then 2 weeks from today, I think, is December 3rd. Is that right? December 3rd is when we're planning on doing what we're calling an open meeting. Some of you have heard that we're going to be doing this. So rather than a Dharma talk and discussion like this, we'll probably just do a 30-minute sit that morning and then allow the group. Andy and I will have some things to go over. And then really, this is an opportunity to everybody speak in a way that they feel heard, just about how you feel as far as what's happening here at Open Mind Zen. We want this to be everybody's home. This isn't just me and Andy running the show here. So an opportunity for everybody to speak. So please mark this on your calendar. And if you're around, make it a priority to be here December 3rd. That's a Sunday. Thank you. Please remember the Donna box. I won't do the whole spiel today, but thank you. You've heard it a million times. Thank you for supporting us. And I wanted to mention quickly that Jeannie, many of you don't know, wrote a book called
Sit with Less Pain.
A book of...
Actually, I brought some with me.
Oh, good.
Yeah,
so we can put those out. A book of yoga postures for meditators and everybody else, right? And we're putting on the calendar January. It's a Tuesday, but
yeah,
we don't
actually,
know yet.
I wanted to talk to you about
okay.
Yeah, maybe a Saturday morning.
Mm-hmm. Maybe a Saturday morning. We're finding a date in January. She's offered to do a free yoga class, about the book with a book signing. So we're really excited that she's going to be doing this in January. So this will all go out in an email, so you'll have the dates.
So I want. Can I make one more announcement? That,
mm-hmm.
So that book I was talking about, the Tower of Rock book, Welcome to Come, we're doing on December 9th at Alvina's house. We're having another meeting about that book. And I brought a copy of it with me to give to Lori, but you can look at it if you want to. So anybody's welcome to come.
This will also go out in an email. Thanks. Karen?
The volunteer off the cushion will be ready to give a presentation.
December 3rd, okay, as part of that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So we're going to venture out to Loudermilk today?